10 hours Greenwich Mean Time. This is Newsdesk in the World Service of the BBC with Michael Poles. The headlines: rival parties in Northern Ireland are on the verge of an historic agreement to end three decades of violence. Negotiators in Belfast worked through the night, long past the original deadline, and are still locked in talks to settle outstanding issues. Other headlines: Russia's Prime Minister-designate has told Parliament of the grave economic problems facing the country as deputies prepare to vote on his nomination. A number of Indonesian immigrants have broken into foreign embassy compounds in the Malaysian capital Kuala Lumpur in an attempt to avoid deportation. Participants in the Northern Ireland peace process are finalising a deal aimed at ending three decades of violence. Negotiations are still continuing, well past the original deadline, but party officials said only minor sticking points remain. Sources at the talk say a full session to endorse a comprehensive settlement will begin soon. The agreement is said to be without precedent in Northern Ireland, including plans for a new assembly in the province and a new mechanism for linking it with the Irish Republic. From the talk's venue at Stormont, here's our political reporter Adam Brimelow.
There's no doubting the magnitude and importance of this hard-won deal. All the sides involved say it's a crucial step towards establishing a lasting peace. But even now, as the parties review the final document, there are conflicting statements on how it will work. A spokesman for the British Prime Minister, Tony Blair, said it only became clear very late in negotiations that a deal would be reached. But he hailed the agreement as a once-in-a-generation opportunity to establish a lasting settlement. The parties are about to convene to give their verdicts on the final paper, and then the proposals will be put to people north and south of the Irish border in a referendum. Seamus Mallon, a senior spokesman for the main Irish nationalist party, the SDLP, says the process of bridging the deep political divide in Northern Ireland has taken a big step forward.
Agreement simply hasn't broken out. It was worked at. People are beginning to understand each other, and there have been a lot of very important human relationships built up during this as well, and we'll build on those.
There's a gathering sense of euphoria at the talks and relief that a deal has come at last. The job of selling the agreement to the people is about to begin.
With more on this, here's our Ireland correspondent Dennis Murray.
Many of the parties here have been saying they dislike the word deal, but what they're in the act of finalising is effectively a new deal in Ulster, Irish and British politics. They're still working on the electoral system for a new devolved assembly, probably on the basis of five seats each in the 18 existing Westminster constituencies and proportional representation. But a civic forum to allow smaller parties a say may be added. There are other complex and difficult areas like policing and the scale of releases of paramilitary prisoners. But the expectation is that soon an agreement on most, if not all, areas that have caused so much division and controversy even in the last few hours of the talks will be announced. If it is, the scale of what's been achieved is difficult to understate. The legacy of 30 years of the horror and bitterness of the Troubles, perhaps even 100 years of political division since the era of the Home Rule debate, will have been superseded with entirely new political arrangements agreed by Unionists, Loyalists, Nationalists, Republicans and the British and Irish governments. It is a historic moment.
Our Ireland correspondent Dennis Murray, and before him you heard Adam Brimelow. President Clinton has expressed support for the negotiations in Belfast. He called the British Prime Minister Tony Blair and the leader of the province's moderate nationalist party early today with a message of congratulations. He is said to have offered to visit Northern Ireland ahead of next month's planned referendum. The Russian Prime Minister-designate Sergei Kirienko has addressed the lower house of parliament, the Duma, ahead of a vote on whether to endorse his nomination by President Yeltsin. The communist-dominated Duma is expected to reject Mr. Kirienko in the first ballot. However, Mr. Yeltsin has said he will not propose another candidate and warned the Duma that every day without a new, stable government would create additional economic problems. Alan Little in Moscow has been following the story.
Mr. Kirienko, in his first speech as acting prime minister, gave a grim prognosis of Russia's economic health. Servicing Russia's debt would swallow three quarters of Russia's federal budget within 5 years unless radical changes were made, he said. The slump in world oil prices would cost Russia billions of dollars this year alone. He said he wanted to fill his government with professionals rather than political appointees loyal to party factions. And he added, a good state is a modest state. The federal government must start by reforming itself. Earlier, President Yeltsin had given him his full backing in a radio address. "We have been living without a government for too long," he said. "The Duma may be willing to tolerate this, but the economy is not. Every day, the questions that require urgent attention pile up." Mr. Yeltsin said he had no other candidate for prime minister and urged the deputies to approve Mr. Kiryenko or face divisive and costly elections. The communist leader, Gennady Zyuganov, who controls the largest single bloc of deputies, said his supporters would vote against Mr. Kiryenko, as did the extreme right-wing nationalist Vladimir Zhirinovsky. Mr. Kiryenko thus faces a crushing defeat and stands to win the support of fewer than 20% of the deputies. The parliament will use his defeat to try to wring more concessions from Mr. Yeltsin. The communists and nationalists want a change of economic policy and representation in the new government. Mr. Yeltsin is unlikely to concede either. If, as expected, Mr. Kiryenko is rejected, backroom negotiations will resume next week before a second debate and vote on Mr. Kiryenko's appointment.
The emergence of Sergei Kiryenko as an important figure in Russian politics has caught many observers by surprise. His appointment by President Yeltsin as acting prime minister following the sacking of Viktor Chernomyrdin was a shock. Few people had heard of Mr. Kiryenko, and even fewer knew anything about him. Our Russian affairs analyst, Stephen Diel, looks at the remarkable rise of Mr. Yeltsin's new protege.
President Boris Yeltsin's decision to appoint the Minister for Fuel and Energy, Sergei Kiryenko, as Prime Minister was an even bigger shock than his sacking of Viktor Chernomyrdin. Mr. Kiryenko moved to the Energy Ministry in Moscow from Nizhny Novgorod less than a year ago. This move was thanks to his close association with Boris Nemtsov, the former governor of Nizhny Novgorod, who'd been appointed as one of two first deputy prime ministers. Under Mr. Nemtsov, the region established a reputation as an important centre for economic reform. Mr. Nemtsov and Mr. Kiryenko, two energetic men in their 30s, seem to embody the spirit of this reform. And it's Mr. Kiryenko's credentials as a reformer which have led President Yeltsin to choose him now as his favoured candidate for prime minister. But however much energy and however many reformist ideas Mr. Kiryenko may have, there's no guarantee that this will enable him to solve the problems dogging Russia's economy any better than did his predecessor. Without a workable tax system, the government will still be short of revenue, meaning that the problem of non or late payment of wages will continue. Mr. Kiryenko tried to diffuse tension caused by the wages issue, which led to nationwide demonstrations on Thursday, by providing money to meet some of the shortfall. But that was a one-off gesture. Until proper legislation is in place and a workable taxation system exists, any Russian prime minister will find his room for manoeuvre is strictly limited.
Our Russian affairs analyst Stephen Diel, and you also heard Alan Little in Moscow. There's growing speculation over the former Bosnian Serb leader Radovan Karadzic after a series of unconfirmed reports that he may be considering giving himself up. Mr. Karadzic and his military chief, General Ratko Mladic, are still at large and their whereabouts are unclear, despite the arrest of other Bosnian Serbs indicted by the International War Crimes Tribunal at The Hague. Reports from Paris, London and Washington, quoting intelligence or diplomatic sources, say Mr. Karadzic has been in contact with the tribunal to discuss terms for his surrender, but officials have not confirmed the reports. You're listening to Newsdesk in the BBC World Service. The authorities in Saudi Arabia say they are continuing efforts to establish the nationalities of at least 118 Muslims who died in a stampede on the last day of the annual Hajj pilgrimage to Mecca. Witnesses said some victims fell off a crowded walkway during a ritual known as stoning the devil, while others were trampled underfoot. The Foreign Ministry in Delhi says at least 24 Indians were among the more than 100 Muslim pilgrims killed in a stampede in Saudi Arabia on Thursday. From the Indian capital, Andrew Whitehead reports.
Indian embassy officials in Saudi Arabia have been visiting hospitals where the dead and injured were taken to make their own assessment of casualties. The Foreign Ministry in Delhi says 24 Indian nationals are known to have died in the stampede, and of those, more than half the bodies have been identified. The new Hindu nationalist Prime Minister, Atal Bihari Vajpayee, has expressed deep grief over the tragedy. India is home to well over 100 million Muslims, by far the biggest religious minority in this mainly Hindu country. Almost 100,000 Indians have gone on the Hajj pilgrimage this year, a sharp increase in the year before. Most have travelled under the auspices of the government-sponsored Central Hajj Committee, which allocates places on the pilgrimage state by state. At Delhi Airport and elsewhere, special facilities, Food, shelter and drinking water are provided for the pilgrims and the huge numbers of friends and family members who come to see them off on what, for devout Muslims, is usually a once-in-a-lifetime experience. The Hajjis, as they're called, often have to pay as much as $1,500 for airfares and accommodation. Last year, about 100 Indian Hajj pilgrims were among more than 300 killed in Saudi Arabia when fire swept through the closely packed tents in which they were being housed.
Andrew Whitehead in Delhi. Police in Bangladesh say 12 people have been injured in a clash between Bengali settlers and tribal people in the southeastern Chittagong Hill Tracts area. It's the first such incident since a peace treaty was signed in December, which formally ended an insurgency by tribal rebels. Police say the latest clash began after a demonstration by tribal people protesting about what they say was an attack on them by Bengali settlers earlier this week. The security forces say the situation is now under control. The Deputy President of South Africa, Thabo Mbeki, has begun a four-day visit to China and has made it clear he won't be raising any human rights issues on his trip. Relations between China and South Africa are only just beginning to stabilise after Nelson Mandela's pursuit of close relations with Taiwan, which China disapproved of. But Mr. Mbeki's visit will underline South Africa's new pragmatic business approach, as our Southern Africa correspondent Jeremy Vine reports.
Mr. Mbeki's visit to Japan has just ended and will have reminded him of what he is up against as Nelson Mandela's anointed heir. Reporters in Tokyo leapt on the fact that a Japanese government spokesman who was asked how Thabo Mbeki's visit was going leafed helplessly through briefing papers as if unsure who he was. The abrupt resignation of South Africa's Defence Force Chief George Mering had earlier edged Mr. Mbeki off the front pages, all of which will remind him as he arrives in China that he has nothing like the pizzazz of Nelson Mandela. But as far as his relationship with China's leaders goes, that may help. Mr. Mandela infuriated them by staying loyal to Taiwan, which had assisted the ANC, his party, in the past, but which China regards as a renegade province. South Africa is looking much more hard-nosed in its attitude to foreign relations with every day that moves Mr. Mbeki closer to power. Taiwan has now been downgraded on the government's list of friends, and Mr. Mandela's deputy said bluntly he would not be raising human rights issues in China. "We are not going to Beijing to raise those sorts of questions," he told a news conference. He may well be criticised for that at home, since the ANC's long battle to overturn apartheid was fought on moral grounds as much as any other. But South Africa's economy needs all the investment and all the foreign markets it can possibly connect with. China's are said to be there for the taking, and Mr. Mbeki, who did not seem that impressed with Japan's attitude to trade with South Africa, has no intention of complicating his pitch in China.
Jeremy Vine in Johannesburg. Police in Malaysia say that more than 20 illegal immigrants from Indonesia have been arrested after forcing their way into the compounds of foreign embassies in Kuala Lumpur. Those who entered the French and Swiss embassies and the diplomatic office of Brunei have been detained, but eight of them are still inside the American embassy. One of our correspondents in the region, Enver Solomon, reports that their actions appear to be an attempt to avoid Malaysia's campaign to repatriate illegal immigrants, many of whom are from Indonesia.
In what appears to have been a carefully planned operation, the Indonesian immigrants scaled the walls of four different embassies early on Friday morning. Most of them were quickly removed by police after embassy officials refused to help. But the eight Indonesians who broke into the American embassy were detained by security guards. The embassy is now seeking advice from the United Nations Refugee Agency. The immigrants are all believed to be from the Indonesian province of Aceh. They say they're political refugees who fled the conflict in their homeland between separatists and the Indonesian army. It's not the first time that Indonesian immigrants in Malaysia have taken such dramatic action. Last month, 14 of them forced their way into a UN office in the capital. The immigrants are still there, hoping to be given asylum. But so far, the Malaysian government has shown little sympathy. Despite protests from human rights groups, it's continuing with plans to expel more than 9,000 illegal immigrants. The government feels overwhelmed by the recent influx of people fleeing the economic crisis in Indonesia. Like many countries in Southeast Asia, there's a strong feeling that foreigners should not be allowed to take the jobs of local workers, and the authorities have been anxious to take immediate action. The immigrants are hoping that their latest move will force the international community to put pressure on the Malaysian government to rethink its policy.
Our Southeast Asia reporter Enver Solomon. Representatives of the indigenous Subanen people in the southern Philippines have accused a Canadian gold mining company of widespread abuses of their rights. One Subanen told the BBC that the company, TVI, had driven 300 families off their land in the Zamboanga region over the past 12 years. He said security personnel working for TVI had also set up a roadblock on a main road into the area, disrupting food supplies. TVI has rejected the allegations. A senior company official told the BBC that TVI had given financial compensation to those who'd been relocated and had provided employment for hundreds of Subanens. A group of lecturers at universities in the second largest city of Indonesia, Surabaya, have stopped teaching in protest against the disappearance of two students during a demonstration on Wednesday. At least 11 other student activists have been reported missing by one of the main human rights organizations there. The disappearances come as students across Indonesia have been mounting demonstrations calling for political and economic reform. From Jakarta, here's Jonathan Head.
The 16 university lecturers say it's their moral duty to protest against the disappearance of two students during a demonstration on Wednesday, which resulted in violent clashes with the security forces. At least one other student is still unaccounted for after earlier demonstrations in Surabaya. Student activists in several other cities have also gone missing. Attempts by their relatives to trace them have got nowhere. In some cases, eyewitnesses say they saw the activists being taken away by armed men, but the military has denied any role in their abduction and says they may just be in hiding. The government-sponsored National Human Rights Commission has launched an investigation into the disappearances. It's urged the government to resolve the matter for fear the practice of disappearing activists may spread as it did in South America during the 1970s. The action by the 16 lecturers in Surabaya shows an increased willingness on the part of the university authorities to support the student protest movement, despite an official ban on politics inside the campuses. The rectors of some universities have actually joined the demonstrations, while others have warned the police to stay off the university grounds. In most cases, the security forces have been willing to follow that advice, and clashes have generally only occurred when the demonstrations have tried to move out onto the streets. But there is growing frustration among some students over the limited impact of their protest movement and over the presence of undercover intelligence officers on the campuses.
Jonathan Head in the Indonesian capital, Jakarta. This is Newsdesk in the BBC World Service. A reminder of the main news. All sides involved in the Northern Ireland peace process have emerged from a marathon session of negotiations and are preparing to endorse an agreement aimed at ending three decades of violence in the province. Correspondents say party officials are euphoric that a settlement appears finally to have been reached. The draft agreement is said to be without precedent and is expected to be adopted shortly at a full session of the talks attended by the British and Irish Prime Ministers. Still to come in this programme, the lower house of the Chilean Congress rejects moves to impeach the former military ruler Augusto Pinochet. And a new study published in Britain says that baby milk manufacturers are flouting international rules to protect babies in the third world. Violence has broken out in the waterfront dispute in Australia, where a shiploading company has replaced 1,400 dockers with non-trade union workers. Several men were injured in clashes in Sydney with police and security guards. The unionised employees were sacked in large numbers on Wednesday, and our reporter in Sydney, Red Harrison, says the industrial dispute is one of the most serious in recent years.
The sacked men are mounting pickets at ports all around Australia, and tempers and frustration flared when a vehicle tried to drive through the blockade in Sydney. At least one man was hurt, reportedly knocked down by the vehicle, and taken to hospital. Police moved in to try to restore order, but dockers charged the wire fence and security gates, which have been chained and locked to keep them out, while non-union workers inside keep the Port of Sydney working. Dockers shouted abuse as security guards tried to repair the fence, and some claim they were sprayed with mace, a fiercely irritant spray which can cause temporary blindness and which is illegal in Australia. Ambulances were called to treat several men. The Dockers Union says it intends to take the shiploading company to court to sue for the illegal use of non-union labour. But the company has strong backing from the government, which says it's determined to help stamp out Australia's appalling reputation for laziness and inefficiency on the docks.
Red Harrison in Sydney. Financial news now. The main European and North American markets are closed for the Good Friday holiday. In Tokyo earlier, the Nikkei share average closed down 55 points at 16,481. On the foreign exchanges, the dollar is trading at 1 German mark 82 and 129 Japanese yen. The pound is at $1.67. The lower house of the Chilean Congress has rejected a proposal to impeach the former military ruler Augusto Pinochet. The motion, which was intended to strip General Pinochet of his status as a senator for life, was defeated by a majority of 62 to 52. The vote took place after a heated debate lasting 9 hours, during which supporters and opponents of the general staged demonstrations in the Parliament building. With more details, here's one of our South America correspondents, Stephen Sveach.
General Pinochet is well known around the world as the man who in 1973 led a bloody military coup and then went on to govern Chile for the next 17 years. Under the Constitution, he can't be tried for any of the thousands of political killings which took place during those years. But after stepping down from the presidency, he stayed on as army commander until last month, and his immunity from prosecution doesn't cover that period. The aim of this motion, therefore, was to impeach the general for allegedly unconstitutional activities committed during the 1990s. These included ordering his men to stage military maneuvers when it appeared that the authorities were investigating his son's business activities. The motion was put forward by a group of deputies from the governing Christian Democratic Party, who hoped to see General Pinochet stripped of his seat as a life senator. However, it soon became clear that the party was deeply split over the issue, with both the current president, Eduardo Frei, and his predecessor, Patricio Aylwin, keen not to endanger Chile's democratic transition. The desire not to rock the boat is probably the main reason why the general has survived this unprecedented attempt to bring him to justice. However, the former military ruler still arouses strong emotions in Chile, and the vote was accompanied by noisy demonstrations. As the result was announced, opponents of the general unfurled a banner saying, "Chile pardons its traitors."
Our South America correspondent Stephen Sveach. Rescue workers in the southern United States are battling through wreckage left by a powerful tornado that killed at least 30 people and injured many more. The tornado flattened hundreds of homes and officials say the death toll is likely to rise. The worst affected state, Alabama, has been declared a disaster zone to enable victims to claim federal compensation. President Clinton has said he'll push ahead with legislation to regulate the tobacco industry, the day after five major American cigarette companies withdrew from a deal to pay compensation for smoking-related illnesses. The companies say a new law, which raises the cost of the deal they agreed, could drive them to bankruptcy. But Mr. Clinton said he was determined to continue to work to regulate the industry in order to protect the nation's health. A BBC correspondent in Washington says the president believes he has public opinion on his side, and few politicians are willing to defend the tobacco industry's case. A new study published in the British Medical Journal says that baby milk manufacturers are continuing to flout international rules designed to protect babies in the third world. The rules are aimed at encouraging poor women to breastfeed rather than buy formula milk, which is less safe and has no extra nutritional benefit. Here's Ruth Linton of our science unit.
Manufacturers of powdered baby milk substitutes are breaking the international code which governs the promotion of their products. The author of the BMJ report carried out a major survey on behalf of the Interagency Group on Breastfeeding. Anna Taylor looked at cities in Bangladesh, Poland, South Africa and Thailand. She found that baby milk manufacturers continue to violate the code by giving free gifts of milk to mothers or indirectly promoting its use by offering free gifts and samples to health workers. The code was adopted by the World Health Assembly in 1981 in an attempt to encourage mothers worldwide to breastfeed their babies and prevent a needless 1.5 million infant deaths a year. These are due mainly to malnutrition and infant diarrhea in children whose mothers can't afford enough of the formula substitutes and lack access to clean water and sterilising equipment for bottles. An accompanying editorial in the BMJ says that the promotional activities of the baby milk manufacturers won't be curbed until the companies are sued for damages by consumers in the same way that the tobacco companies are, and urges governments to incorporate the rules of the Code of Marketing into national legislation.
Ruth Linton of our science unit. Now sport, and the Sri Lankan athlete known as the fastest woman in Asia has been suspended from competition, and five players have been sent off in the latest match in South American football's Libertadores Cup. Gordon Farker has the details.
Susantika Jayasinghe has been suspended following confirmation of a positive drug test. Jayasinghe confirmed her status as the fastest woman in Asia when she took silver in the 200 metres at the World Championships last year. An out-of-competition drug test revealed traces of the banned steroid nandrolone. The International Amateur Athletic Federation say they don't accept Jayasinghe's explanation that the samples hadn't been properly sealed and could have been interfered with. She's been suspended by the Sri Lankan Athletics Association and is facing a two-year ban. Jayasinghe continues to protest her innocence. The Libertadores Cup is South America's biggest interclub competition, and for the first time this year, Mexican teams have been admitted. The latest fracas involving one of them, America, happened in Rio de Janeiro in the match against Vasco da Gama. From Brazil, Tim Vickery reports.
This was a game which saw more sendings off than shots on goal. Amid chaotic scenes, the Ecuadorian referee showed the red card on five occasions, and an all-out brawl at the end of the game was only prevented by a prompt police invasion. Alberto Garcia Asti gave the visitors the lead with an early penalty, but after a series of bad-tempered exchanges, he was the first player to be ordered off. Vasco lost centre-backs Ojivan and Alex before the numbers were levelled when America right-back Salvador Lara was also sent off. America bizarrely tried to replace Lara. Reserve right-back Terraza wandered nonchalantly onto the field and was in earnest conversation with his teammates when the referee noticed him and sent him off. The game finished at 1-1, but it was a night of inexplicable violence. Both teams had already qualified for the next round.
Tim Vickery. Well, Fred Couples takes a one-shot lead into today's second round of the first golf major of the year, the Masters at Augusta. He hits an opening round of 69. Tiger Woods, the defending champion, is two shots off the lead.
And that was Gordon Farker. Well, today sees two of the world's main religions holding festivals. It's the start of the Jewish Passover, and Christians are marking the Easter holiday. Today also sees the end of the Muslim festival of Eid al-Adha. All three celebrate themes of sacrifice and liberation. Our religious affairs reporter Jane Little says that all have, to varying degrees, some political resonance.
Millions of Muslims across the world are emerging from days of feasting as the festival commemorating the story of the prophet Abraham, who was prepared to sacrifice his son, draws to a close. It's a story of obedience and sacrifice that has clear parallels in Christianity's celebration of Easter. Today, Christians in the Western tradition remember the death of Jesus, who they believe to be God's son, sacrificed by God for the world. Good Friday, as it's called, is a solemn day of repentance and prayer. In Latin America, believers dressed in dark robes form processions through the streets, while in some extreme cases, Christians in the Philippines have themselves nailed to a cross to reenact the crucifixion. Meanwhile, the Jewish Passover marks the liberation of Jews from slavery in Egypt over 3,000 years ago. The Seder meal is the central ritual, where family members traditionally recount the story through symbolic food and readings. While the Muslim festival is a time for charity and the freeing of prisoners, Easter, celebrated on Sunday as the day of Christ's resurrection, draws political messages from religious leaders to end conflicts and encourage peace. As Israel nears its 50th birthday, while the Middle East peace process falters, and with the future of Northern Ireland far from assured, many believers feel the messages of hope and deliverance are all the more resonant.
Our religious affairs reporter Jane Little. And you can't even buy the traditional Good Friday hot cross bun in the BBC canteen. Well, now, to end news desk, here are the main points again. After all-night talks in Northern Ireland, well past the midnight deadline, it now looks as if a peace deal has been brokered to end the long-running conflict. Sources at the talks say a full session to endorse a comprehensive settlement will begin soon. The agreement is said to include plans for a new assembly in the province and a new mechanism for linking it with the Irish Republic. There are indications that concerns voiced earlier by the political wing of the IRA, Sinn Féin, may now have been met. The Russian parliament is about to vote on President Yeltsin's choice of Sergei Kiryenko for prime minister. He's made it clear that if they reject his choice, he won't propose another candidate. And Malaysian police say numbers of illegal Indonesian immigrants have been arrested after forcing their way into the compounds of four foreign embassies in the capital, Kuala Lumpur. Those are the latest headlines, ending News Desk from the BBC.